Hey everybody, it's another episode of the TV Insider Podcast, and it's that time of year again, the summer press tour for the Television Critics Association. I'm Jim Halchman, West Coast Bureau Chief of TV Guide Magazine, and while we're getting a plethora of great content for our upcoming fall preview issue and the issues before and after, I can tell you there are a lot of great new shows coming up on all the networks and broadcast and streaming and cable. Everybody's got some really great things coming, so you'll want to keep listening back for our following podcast because we have some really great interviews and news coming for you. One of the new series that's actually getting a jump start on all the avalanche of fall TV is AMC's The Terror, Infamy. I sat down at the summer press tour last week with executive producer Alexander Wu and star George Takei to get a closer look into making this new season of the horror series. But before we get into that, I've got senior critic Matt Rausch here to give us his take on The Terror, as well as the second season of HBO's family drama, Succession. Take it away, Matt.
Hi, this is Matt Rausch, senior critic for TV Guide magazine, and here's a couple of ideas of what you might be wanting to watch over the next couple of days. August used to be the slowest time in television. That is no longer the case. My calendar is pretty much full, no matter what time of year it is. But there's a couple of very interesting shows right on the horizon. On Sunday, HBO brings back its series Succession for a second season. First season was a little bit of a slow burn until toward the end that really built into a really harrowing climax. And this family, the Roy family, the way I look at it is that somewhere in TV heaven, J.R. Ewing is looking down at the Roy family and saying, man, I never pushed it that far, because this is one family that is at each other's throats. The whole idea of Succession is you've got a media family based pretty much like on the Murdochs, but there's a little bit of Trumpism in there too. But it's really about how a very wealthy family with a lot of power and influence in the media, what happens when the patriarch is seen as vulnerable, as possibly failing? He's sort of King Lear of his empire, and everybody is jockeying position for position because they know that whatever comes next, he's going to have to name an heir to the throne. I'm not sure it's a crown anybody really wants to have, especially in the new media landscape, but Succession is a really fascinating story of sibling rivalry, as these characters just tear into each other. In the first season, the son named Kendall tried a palace coup, basically. He was orchestrating a takeover to take his father down. It blew up in his face, and in this second season, Kendall is like a walking zombie. He's like shell-shocked. His sister, Shiv, looks to be the heir apparent because she's actually savvy. The other kids in the family are just absolute losers. These are all grown children who are basically groveling for favor and attention. In the third episode, later this month, they go off on a company retreat, and by the end, they are actually on the floor groveling for this old man's favor and forgiveness, because he sees snakes at every turn. Succession is both harrowing and hilarious. It's very well written, very well acted. It's funny. It's just horrifying at times, but because it's a high drama of low behavior, basically, and that's what makes Succession really work. It's a particular favorite of mine. It is Emmy nominated for best drama. It probably won't win, but it has certainly made an impact in its first season. I think it's going to make much more noise in the second season, and it begins on Sunday night, the 11th of August. One night later, something completely different. The new season of the AMC supernatural drama, The Terror. This is called The Terror, Infamy. The first season was set in the Arctic in the 1800s. This is set in California and the Pacific Northwest in 1940s as Pearl Harbor happens. And the idea of The Terror as an anthology franchise is that it takes historical events and lays a supernatural story around it. In this particular season, Infamy is built around the incarceration of Japanese Americans in internment camps after Pearl Harbor. They are seen as potential enemies, and they are rounded up and put in basically concentration camps. But within this Japanese-American community, there are spirits from the old country who are beginning to haunt some of these characters. You're not exactly sure why. There's a lot of interesting backstory here, but it's that really creepy Japanese horror style where it's very graphic when the demons make their presence known. It's a creepy story. At the same time, it's a historical horror story because what happened to the Japanese Americans was unforgivable. But compounding that horror with supernatural terror makes one of the most original shows you'll see all summer. And that begins Monday, August 12th. This is Matt Rausch, senior critic of TV Guide magazine. I'll be back a little bit later with some more picks.
Thanks, Matt. I've seen the first few episodes of The Terror Infamy, and it's a really great historical take on the 1940s and the horrors both in humanity and the not-so-human. It's scary stuff, but also really seeped in character and some really compelling stuff that I haven't seen on a show in a long time that's kind of considered a horror show. But here's my chat with executive producer Alexander Wu and star George Takei. So we're here at TCA. I'm talking to Alexander Wu and George Takei for Terror the Infamy, which premieres August 12th. Is that correct? I don't know how I kept that in my brain. But congratulations. I've seen a couple episodes. Alex, I wanted to first talk to you because this is a different story from the first season. Are there any threats to the first season, even like just the look or anything with that, or is it completely its own season?
Well, I like to tell anyone who is a big fan of the first season that they will get exactly none of it in the second season, because it's a different story, a different team of writers, a different cast, a different setting. However, it does share a good deal of the DNA of the first season in that we are telling an historical story using a genre vocabulary to amplify the terror of the historical experience. And also, both stories are about a group of people who are aliens in a strange land where they're not wanted. And the horror is as much human-driven as it is supernaturally driven. So those are two things we share, but in terms of subject matter and cast and the writing, of course, it's a completely different story.
Okay. So we're in the 1940s. There's internment camps. There's a lot of just chaos in the world, which sounds a lot like today's world. Mm-hmm. But why was that a story you wanted to tell?
Well, it is, in fact. I mean, George would be, you know, the best person to speak to this, but. We could have told this story any time and it would have been relevant. The story of the internment is one that speaks to any immigrant experience and anyone whose life has been touched by the immigrant experience, which in this country is just about everyone.
Yes.
It would still hold a relevance. Now, it is particularly poignant and urgent at this very moment in history. We didn't plan for it to be that way. I wish it were that way. But quite frankly, you know, this is a universal story that will be relevant in 50 years and 100 years and would have been relevant 30 years ago.
Yeah. George, you're a consultant on the show, but you're also in the show. But can you talk about bringing your own personal knowledge of these camps and that world at the time, since you played a big part in that?
Well, my actual experience in the confinement was when I was 5 years old. I just turned five, and a few weeks after that, my parents got me up very early one morning, together with my brother, a year younger, and my baby sister, an infant, dressed as her. And my brother and I were told to wait in the living room while my parents did some packing back in the bedroom. And so the two of us were just gazing out the front window, and suddenly we saw two soldiers marching up our driveway. They carried rifles with shiny bayonets on them. They stomped at the front porch and with their fists began pounding on the door. I remember the whole house seemed to vibrate under that pounding. It was terrifying. My father came out of the bedroom and asked to open the door, and literally at gunpoint, we were ordered out of our house. So that was, you know, the terrifying beginning. But we were taken from there to the horse stables of Santa Anita Racetrack and housed in a horse stall, still pungent with a stink of horse manure. And this is where the parallel story begins. I thought it was fun to sleep with the horses. And if you breathe deeply, you could smell the horses. For my parents, going from a two-bedroom home on Garnet Street in Los Angeles into this stench where a horse was kept with their three children, was a degrading, painful humiliating experience. And so my real memories are fun memories. We were taken from there to the swamps of Arkansas, another exotic place for me, where everything was different. Trees grew out of water, the bayou, the roots snaking in and out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was different and exciting. And it was an adventure of discovery for me, but for my parents, to be stripped of everything that they have worked for all their lives. Their bank account was frozen and taken away. My home was lost because of that. My father's business was lost. We're innocent. We had nothing to do with Pearl Harbor. We're Americans. My mother was born in Sacramento. My father was in San Francisco. They met and married in Los Angeles. The kids were born in Los Angeles. And yet, we looked like the people that gone Pearl Harbor. And with no trial, no charges, no due process, we were in prison. And so for my parents to be incarcerated, innocent, and herded around by soldiers with rifles was a degrading, anguishing experience. For me, it was an adventure in an exotic place. And it wasn't until I was a teenager that I started to search for information about that experience, and the only source of it was my father, and I learned from him about how he felt, and all of the details. My father was a block manager, the liaison between the camp command and the people within the camp, and his job was also to keep order within the block. And because of the stressful, anguishing circumstances, you know, there were all sorts of problems. Some people were accused of being informants. Marriages were stressed. And so my father's experience was quite different from the others. And I was able to get my father to share that with me. So the internment itself, for me, was a different parallel experience from that of my parents. And it's after the imprisonment itself that I began to learn about it, do some research on my own about it, and through my father's guidance, learn the importance of our participating in a participatory democracy to try to make our democracy a better, truer democracy.
Yeah, and everything you're saying, there's images of that in the show, which surprised me in a way because I thought, oh, this is a horror story, and I expect it to be monsters and now they're fighting that, but there's kind of a dual thing happening, or maybe they're not as dual as it comes across in the beginning because there's two horrors, I guess, happening.
Yeah, I mean, it was as important for me to tell the historical story factor as possible, and then use the horror elements to bring out the emotions of the experience so that it doesn't feel like a sterile museum piece. Because the last thing you want is for the viewer to feel at a safe remove from the subject matter and feel, oh, that happened 75 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, that couldn't possibly happen again today. You want the viewer to be in the skin of those characters.
Sure.
And what better way to do it than to, you know, use all the tools in the toolbox, including the genre elements. We're certainly by no means the first production to ever do that. There have been others to really bring out that feeling so the viewer will have the same constant feeling of dread and fear that that our characters do.
Yeah. Was it a challenge to juggle those two, to tell this historical story, but then also bring in the other element that you wanted to bring in?
Well, everything's a challenge, for sure, but that was the conceit from the beginning.
Yeah.
That was the strategy from the very beginning, and it gave us an additional set of toys to play with,
mm-hmm.
Instead of just telling it straight as a docudrama, because there have been many wonderful documentaries that have been made, but there's an opportunity here in a scripted form with actors bringing this story to life over a period of 10 weeks that you feel you would want the viewer to feel like they're going on a journey with these characters, and these become their friends, their allies through this through this journey.
Yeah. What is Obake? We see that
Obake literally translated means ghost.
Okay.
Yure is more like spirit, but these are all organic to the people. We're talking about the immigrant generation bringing with them the old country beliefs, parts of the Japanese Buddhist religion, and some of the rituals that go with it. And it's organic to the people that were incarcerated.
Okay.
Many of the first generation, the immigrant generation, brought that over. And there's also the additional tension between the American-born generation, who think that that's superstition.
Yeah. You know?
But that does guide the lives of the immigrant generation in reacting to this new and strange terrifying condition that they're put into.
Yeah.
We use this belief in spirits to delineate the difference between the Issei immigrant generation and the Nisei generation, which is, you know, Chester, our lead character, who doesn't believe in any of it. Until we get further enough in the story where he has no choice but to believe in it. But that to me is indicative of a generation that's born in America and wants to distance himself from the country his parents came from, fully embracing America, and then discovering certainly that America is not embracing him back, which he discovers soon afterwards. So there's a generational story at play as well. And we use a number of words, bakemono, obake, yure in particular, that refer to these spirits in the Japanese culture. And we use all of those words because at the beginning, no one is sure what it is.
Right.
You know, a bakemono is sort of a general spirit that has this more of a sinister connotation. Obake doesn't necessarily have a sinister connotation. It's a spirit. A yurei is a vengeful ghost. Is the spirit of a deceased person who cannot rest. So then that's something very specific. But at the beginning, no one knows what's haunting them.
Okay, that's part of the thing that pulls the viewer through it, because you want to find out too.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, because watching the show, and I was thinking back to your legacy on television when you were on Star Trek in the 60s, you were probably one of the few Asian actors on television. I'm watching this show, I'm like, I'm seeing a lot of Japanese people telling a Japanese story. Can you talk about what that means to you, just the fact that the world has changed enough and this is something people are going to want to see?
It's that aspect, the groundbreaking aspect of this show, that is so exciting. There were Asian characters before I got Star Trek, but they were all stereotypes. They were small roles, peripheral roles, stereotypes that are unattractive. The silent servant, or the buffoon, or the villain, the evil one. And so with Star Trek, it was the first time that we were able to play a role that was a part of the leadership team of the Starship Enterprise, boldly going where no one had gone before.
Yeah.
And it was literal with certainly the depiction of Asian Americans and the diversity of this planet working together in concert as a team. With the Terror Infamy, we have a whole cast, and beyond that, hundreds of extras that are of Asian ancestry,
and specifically Japanese.
Specifically Japanese, but with the extras, we had the Chinese and Korean. We all
very few, very very few. We In the internment camp itself, everyone was a Japanese ancestry.
Oh, really?
You know that?
No. So you're staying true to that.
Quite a feat. It was no small feat.
With the cast, they had a Korean American, Korean Canadian Korean. What's his name?
Lee Short.
Yeah.
He's half Korean, he's half Japanese.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah.
I see.
No, he told me he was adopted.
He was adopted. That's he was adopted by an Australian family, but he was a Korean on both his mother's and father's side.
And how did he discover that he had
some ancestry?
He
found his birth parents.
My mother's side. It has some Korean.
Oh, really?
It's suspected that we have some Korean. You know, in wartime, every nation tries to advertise their purity and their superiority. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese were supposed to be a pure race. But it's one of the most mixed Asian groups. The Chinese from China, the Koreans from Korea. The Malays from Southeast Asia, and we're the product of the mixture of all of Asia, although during the war, Japan was supposed to be a supreme race, just like, you know, other people during the Second World War, where they were the Ubermenschs.
Well, congratulations on the show. It's what I've seen already, I'm really impressed with, and I do love the layers that we see in the characters and the story, so congratulations.
Thank you, Jim.
I think fans
will
love it.
Keeps you hanging.
The Terror Infamy premieres on August 12th on AMC. Now, Matt Rausch is back to talk about some more of his TV recommendations this month. Here we go.
Hey, this is Matt Rausch. I'm back with some more TV picks. I'm the senior critic for TV Guide magazine, and I've got a few more August selections that you might want to check out. On Thursday, August 15th, CBS All Access welcomes Mark Cherry back to TV. You might remember him as the executive producer of Desperate Housewives, and he has a new show that has that same kind of flavor to it. It's a little bit campy. It's a little bit crazy. The show is called Why Women Kill. That is a very provocative title, but then so is Desperate Housewives. And the genius part of Why Women Kill is that it's set over three distinct time periods. Couples living in the same house in Pasadena. It's kind of like a mansion of sorts. It looks different in the era. You're in the 1960s, you're in the 1980s, and you're in 2019 with couples who are dealing with infidelities and other marital problems, and it's going to escalate in a death at some point. The hook is not unlike, remember the first season of Big Little Lies, where you weren't sure who was going to die and who was going to kill the person. You just know somebody's going to die. Well, in each of these three time frames, somebody's going to bite the bullet, but you don't really know who's going to pull the trigger. You figure the woman's going to be behind it because the show's called Why Women Kill, and they all have a very good reason. In the 1960s, Jennifer Goodwin, you'll remember her from Once Upon a Time, she's playing basically a June Cleaver housewife who's taking great care of her husband and then finds out he's cheating. In the 1980s, we have Lucy Liu, who's going all Alexis Carrington here, playing a crazy socialite, and she finds out her husband has been unfaithful in a very different kind of a way and is very flamboyant, that particular storyline. And that husband is played by Jack Davenport, if you remember from Smash. Really great character actor here. And in the third time frame, the modern story is, I think, something I really haven't seen before, and I think it's really new territory for Mark Cherry here, where you've got a young couple in an open relationship. Reed Scott from Veep is the husband here, but his wife is basically a bisexual who is playing in the field in this open relationship, open marriage. But when she brings her latest, quote, playmate back into the house, all of a sudden Reed Scott gets really interested. So is this going to become a menage a trois? Again, it's about the idea of this sort of like pansexual sort of way that people live their lives nowadays, and it's really interesting. So as each of these three time frames and storylines interweave with each other, you get a sense, apparently they're going to be interconnected by the very end, but each one of them has its own distinct flavor and tone, and it's a really nice way to tell a story, and it's It's got that sort of campy element that you might expect from Mark Cherry. His best work was in Desperate Housewives, and I think he's really on his game here now. And he seems particularly thrilled with the fact that it's only going to be 10 episodes. He doesn't have to fill a whole season of like 22 hours. And in this, it's all going to be told in the 10 episodes. The entire story is going to have a beginning, middle, and end. If there's a second season of Why Women Kill, it's going to be different women killing different people. So we'll see. But I think in this first season, it's going to be a real fun show to watch. And shifting gears entirely, one day later on Friday, August 16th, Netflix brings us a second season of Mindhunter, one of the more fascinating shows from last year. This is a show set in the 1980s where the science of serial killer investigation was brand new. You've got Jonathan Groff and Holt McCallany are these detectives or they're FBI agents who are pursuing the world of serial killers. They're getting inside the heads of people like Charles Manson or the Son of Sam, but they're also, the Atlanta child murders are just happening. So maybe they can put their profiling is a brand new art at this point. So they're putting their gifts to use, but it's a very intense series from David Fincher, you know, from the movies, who does some of the most intense movies ever. But Mindhunter plays mind games with its detectives as well, because as you know, when you get inside the mind of a serial killer, it kind of creeps your own mind out. And so Jonathan Groff's character in particular has proven susceptible to, you know, just freaking out because of how close they're getting to pure human evil. So Mindhunter is one of these shows I am looking forward to binging myself. So make a date on August 16th for Mindhunter on Netflix. This is Matt Rausch, senior TV critic for TV Guide magazine. I'll be back in a few weeks with some more TV picks as the fall season begins, because TV never stops.
Thanks so much to Matt Rausch and to all of you for checking us out again this week. You can subscribe to the podcast for free wherever you get your podcasts. And please make sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at TV Insider. Thanks to our producer, Lori Perna, editor, Sammy Junio, and to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode of the TV Insider podcast, where our Damien Holbrook sits down with Pennyworth star Jack Bannon to talk about some shocking twists and turns coming up on the new Epix series. Until then, thanks so much. Goodbye.